order, and we're going to have a public hearing on, I'm going to switch the order here and just take SJM 8 first, since Senator Yee is here, and some of her constituents and people are ready to testify on that, and if Senator Shields won't hold it against me. So we'll open the public hearing on SJM 8. And go ahead, Senator Yee. You can bring anyone up here you want if you want to.
Well, Mr. Chairman, could I ask Mike Cunningham to come up with me and Mr. Spoon would want to come up also?
Yeah. Like we have the best job in the restaurant, huh?
Yeah.
I'll just let you proceed as you wish in the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm State Senator May Yee, representing Senate District 19, consisting of portions of Lynn and Benton counties. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of St. John Memorial 8, which calls for increased awareness and more funding for the research, treatment, and cure of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, abbreviation is ALS, more commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease, which affects 30,000 Americans every year and about 150 Oregonians. Also, almost 5,000 new cases are reported every year. Once thought to be uncommon, we now know that ALS is as common as multiple sclerosis. ALS deteriorates motor neurons. This causes tripping and falling, loss of motor control, difficulty in speaking, persistent fatigue, twitching, and cramping. Eventually, the ALS patient becomes completely paralyzed, though with no loss of mental capacity. ALS usually strikes men who are over 50 years of age. However, in some cases, they are in their 20s and 30s. The life expectancy of an ALS patient is about 2 to 5 years from the date of diagnosis. Unfortunately, there is no cure for ALS. There is no proven therapy either. Because of the debilitating effects of ALS and the lack of cure or even effective treatment, I urge the passage of St. John Memorial 8. More federal funding is needed for research and treatment. Also, awareness and understanding of this disease must be increased. St. John Memorial 8 will help to send a message to Congress, and I urge your support of St. John Memorial 8. At this time, I would like to introduce Michael Cunningham from Albany, Mrs. Pat Spoon, his mother. And there are two members in the audience that Mike will introduce.
Okay. I brought with me Bob Munson and David.
Oh, would you like to get me? Okay, I'm going to see that. Bob Munson. Are you still a teacher from Albany?
Yes. Yes, I'm a teacher in West Albany High School, where I've been since 1970.
go ahead and say your name for the record.
Bob Monson, M-O-N-S-O-N. Mike has ALS, and one of the problems with the illness is that under any kind of stress at his stage of the illness, he's unable to speak.
Mr. Chair, if I might comment, and there's nothing that would cause more stress than having to appear before a group like us, so we understand that most people have stress up here.
I told them that you were all just regular folks, but In any case, I'm having times under stress. It would be better if we were that way.
So we understand, Mike.
And in any case, if I may, then he's asked me to be here in case he was unable to read this, and I will read his comments as they are printed. There are currently 30,000 people living with ALS in the U.S., with 5,000 new cases.
Sorry?
I think I'll begin at the beginning.
Here.
Yeah. Members of the committee, Senator Yee, my name is Mike Cunningham. I reside in Albany, Oregon, where I live with my wife, Janelle, and daughters, Jenna and Ashton. I am employed at West Albany High School, where I have worked as both teacher and coach for the past 9 years. I was diagnosed with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, on November 26, 1997, 4 months following my 30th birthday. At the time of my diagnosis, I was given no hope for treatment or cure. I believe, however, together we can change this. I come before you today with hopes that you will realize the same sense of urgency felt by those afflicted with ALS. As I am sure you know, ALS is a neurodegenerative disease that robs its victims of their ability to move voluntary muscle, including muscles responsible for speaking, swallowing, and breathing. The average lifespan for a person afflicted with ALS ranges from 2 to 5 years, with death ultimately resulting from respiratory failure. The person's intellect remains intact, however, rendering them totally aware of their daily degeneration, as well as the fear of what lies ahead. There is no question regarding the devastating nature of ALS, but the anguish pales in comparison when one considers the fact that we are dealing with a very treatable and curable disease. There are currently 30,000 people living with ALS in the U.S., with 5,000 new cases and 5,000 deaths resulting each year. Statistically, classified as an orphan disease, ALS often goes unnoticed when allocating funds for research. The fact that ALS has been among us for over 100 years and has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives has also gone unnoticed. ALS research at this time is very promising, yielding many possible treatments and theoretical cures. We have gained more knowledge regarding the possible mechanisms of ALS in the past 5 years than we have had in the entire history of the disease. However, the lack of funding for further research has severely hindered our ability to move forward. We rely heavily on overflow research from other neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and Alzheimer's. It is time ALS be brought to the forefront and be treated with the same sense of urgency as those more publicized diseases. Generating advocacy for ALS is extremely difficult because the majority of ALS victims are either dead or severely disabled, rendering them unable to advocate for themselves, which leaves a very small percentage of ALS victims like myself who are capable of speaking up. It is incomprehensible to me that we have allowed 100 years to pass without giving ALS the serious attention and proper funding it deserves. We are in great need of others like yourselves to help us in this seemingly impossible situation of raising awareness and funds to further research. We are not dealing with a hopeless cause. It just seems as such because of the limited time and resources allocated for it. I realize it is difficult for you to feel the grave sense of urgency regarding this terrible disease without having lived it firsthand. Some of the ALS community have bonded together and used the acronym WIN, which stands for Whatever is Necessary. I hope by my being here and sharing my thoughts and experience with you, that you are moved to do whatever is necessary. By recommending this bill to Congress, you will be making a statement that it is no longer acceptable for Americans to die as a result of ALS and that better treatments and a cure should be made a priority. Thank you for this opportunity to address all of you today. Please act swiftly. Mike Cunningham.
Senator Yee, before I I would guess that it would be your intention to carry this bill if it's passed.
I would be pleased to be able to do that. Mr. Chairman, I have invited another family who has Lou Gehrig's disease to come this morning, but she couldn't do it because she said in order to go to church at 11, she has to get up at 7 to be able to come. So to be here at 8, she almost had to get up at midnight to be able to get ready.
Mm-hmm.
But she would send a letter. I haven't received it yet, but I'll submit it to the committee as soon as I receive it.
She'll be glad to accept it in as evidence and testimony.
I was going to say that I think my son has pretty much read it all.
You're sure welcome to come up, and as long as you're here and get your name on the record. And
my name is Pat Spoon, and I'm Mike's mom. And pretty much what I was going to say, I think, has already been said, but it's short, so I'll go ahead anyway.
Sure, go ahead, Eric.
Lou Gehrig has been gone for a long time, yet the disease that bears his name is still out there. After all these years, there is still no known cause, and there is no cure. ALS has traditionally been a disease that strikes middle-aged people. Not anymore. My son is 31, a young husband and father of two girls. He has it. More and more recently, people his age are being diagnosed. A young girl, 17, was recently diagnosed. Over the past year, I've talked to many, many people with ALS. I never heard a word of complaint or negativity, only encouragement. Everyone lives for tomorrow. The day the cure will come. Is it an environmental cause? We don't know. Is it a virus? We don't know. Is it damaged genes? We don't know. And we need to know. Scientists are taking a good look at the rise of ALS in agricultural areas. Oregon is such an area. Time is a luxury for PALS, people with ALS, a luxury they don't have. And that is why we so desperately need funding for medical research now. Won't you please help? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Are there questions from
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Castillo.
I did want to just ask a little bit. You said there's a rise of ALS in agricultural areas.
Well, when Mike was first diagnosed, the doctor was extremely interested to know if he came from an agricultural area. And it seems that there are studies being done looking at pesticides and fertilizers as a cause of gene damage. There's just tons of research on it.
You said in Oregon, Is that kind of research going on here in Oregon then, or is it?
I don't know. Is it mine?
At OHSU.
OHSU has some research going on.
Yes, I'm saying.
But nothing's been conclusive.
No.
No.
They're just trying to tie it together.
Right. I guess it all comes to funding.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just would comment. I really appreciate Mike coming before us today, and Bob and his mom, too, for Senator Yee. I mean, I know that's a lot of effort to do that, but I think it's certainly important for the awareness, because the trouble is often we just accept things, and it makes it real when I see you and talk to you and think about your family and all of those things. So thank you very much.
Another thing, if I may say, Mike played football for Oregon State University, and he's not the only one that has ALS from that time period. There are others.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At Oregon State?
Yeah.
There's been five other Oregon State football players that have been diagnosed.
Would you come and...
My name is David Kale. I'm a friend of Mike who went to high school and college together.
And the statistics of ALS is only 3 to 5 people out of every 100,000 are diagnosed with ALS. So the chances of 5 people in about a 15-year period from one area all coming up with the same disease are, those are the kind of things that make people believe possibly it is something that's affected in the treatments that Oregon State used on their grass. Not singling out Oregon State that they did anything wrong. It's just, you know, nobody would know that that could be a cause, but it definitely could be. Because, you know, when you're out practicing football and you're eating grass for weeks and weeks on end, that can be something that maybe they were all susceptible to that thing that was.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
When was that? What period of time was that?
I believe the first person, his name's Jeremiah, Bob Jeremiah, and he is about 50 years old. So, and Mike graduated in 90. So from about a 30-year period, I would guess, there were 5 people. And 3 of them are still living right now. One's just a little bit older than Mike, and lives in Portland. His name's Mike Lopez. He also has a
disease. She is age 30.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all onset was a young age. All of them were diagnosed with in the 30 to 40 range.
imagine there's more than one strain of the disease, and I guess I'm asking you a question. And also, is there genetics involved in any of the 5 cases, family histories of ALS in any of these 5 cases?
No.
Sporadic.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting because the gentleman that I, whose name I brought up on and put on the bill here, also wants to OSU.
Really?
And he was, I'm guessing, in his late 20s or early 30s, very early 30s, but not his late 20s when he came down with it.
That was Mike Mulbeck,
am I telling him? No, Chad Risman.
Mr. Chad, he also played football?
He was athletic, but he was a pharmacist and went to pharmacy school, so I don't know how much he actually played athletics, but Lou Gehrig was an athlete before the time of what we might think of as pesticides was invented. They didn't have any of the DDTs or the fertilizers, the things we used, pretty natural fertilizers. as far as the wheat sprays and all that kind of stuff, they were pretty non-existent prior to about the early 70s to mid-50s, late-40s, left World War II, basically. Lots of those things came in where they were released nature that you could use them on a commercial basis as far as grass and wheat and grain raising and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Of course, there's a lot, I can't, thousands and thousands of football and baseball players who spend a lifetime on the turf. I don't think of anybody in my mind besides Gary of a professional athlete.
No, that's not true.
I'm just asking.
Yeah. No, there's lots of athletes that have been diagnosed with abuse. At the San Francisco 49ers alone have 4 players. Mike went to a doctor specifically for that reason in California. That specifically was looking also at the 49ers. There is a high correlation between spinal cord trauma and the disease. And obviously football players have a lot of spinal cord trauma. There's a catfish hunter, I don't know if you've heard of him, he was just diagnosed with the disease just a few weeks ago. So there's lots of athletes that get Lou Gehrig's disease. There's been several football players just in the last 5 years that have died from it. And the point I was making with Oregon State is that there's a high correlation. So if you think about statistically, 3 to 5 out of every 100,000 people get into the disease.
Mm-hmm.
There's at the most 150 people on a football team.
And if you look at that over, you know, a 5 to 7 year period, which they had a real high correlation of it in that small period of time, it's just statistically, it's not likely that there's not something going on.
Mr. Chair, I thought you said it was over a 30-year period.
Well, there were three people just in a, how long was it, like maybe 6 years?
Yeah.
Just recently.
That's an interesting thing, because I know in a little grade school I went to, we had 80 kids in the whole grade school. And the boy in my grade and the girl in the grade behind me both had multiple sclerosis. Just bang, bang like that. And I don't know of any other case of multiple sclerosis that's come out of that school either before or since.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've often wondered, you know, why would two of them like that, they weren't real close associates or anything, lived on opposite sides of the town by several miles each, and if that was any type, so they weren't any relatives of each other or anything like that, if you could pin down, one was a girl, one was a boy, one had it very hard early on, and passed away, the fellow's still living, and fought it for years, and the same age I am, 63, and a young lady passed away probably 25 years ago. So, some of these things you have a hard time really putting
Here, this is one thing, we need to get on with the research.
Yeah.
That's it, because we can speculate all we want, but the research is what's really, put all those factors in and see what it is, and I'm excited about sending this forward. I think this is the there ought to be a lot of interest, and I'd be very happy if the Oregon Legislative Assembly shows that commitment to.
Well, I would like to, if there's no further questions, I'd like to thank all of you for coming today, and
thank you.
Mike, we just wish you the very best in your family, and of course we'd all dear to love it if we could find something that put you back out there full bore. And it's certainly worth working for.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go into a session on SJMA 8.
Chair, I move we send it forward with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves that we send it to the Senate forward with the due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion?
Yes.
Yes,
Senator. Is it some sort of ways and means? Is that are we going to catch funding?
No, this is SJM. This is a memorial to Congress.
I know, I got it right. Okay.
And so it doesn't have a fiscal. Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Yee will carry the bill. And Mike, it's on its way. Open the hearing on SJM 7. Senator Shields, go right ahead.
What's going on? Are we having a recess?
No, Senator Shields is going.
Oh, everybody left.
This is my bill.
Everybody left. Okay.
Okay. I was kind of responding to Senator Shannon and seeing if the recess was over before.
Well, three out of the four of us.
Yeah.
Right. Never took
I've, of course, been on some of the same interim committees as Senator Fisher has, and during the last interim, we did some study of the issue of long-term care for elderly folks. I've been to some conferences in other parts of the country on the issue.
and I'm convinced that we have to address the issue of long-term care responsibility from a different direction than just to use Medicaid, Medicare like we have in the past. And I think that that includes consideration of the human as well as the financial implications. I've got for you some testimony. It's got some statistics in it. Every 8 seconds in America right now, a baby boomer turns 50, and almost half of them are going to need long-term care of some sort. But, at the same time, currently only 3% of us have any kind of long-term care insurance. That just doesn't add up. 80 to 90% of our federal Medicaid dollars are used during the last 2 years of life. I'd like to stop and ask you to think about that. We complain a lot about, you know, how much Medicaid money gets used with women and children, and when we get, you know, all frustrated about welfare reform and the costs and so on, but 80 to 90% of the Medicaid dollars are spent during people's last 2 years of their lives. Almost all of them. The other end, on the human side, we actually have individuals out there getting divorced so that a spouse can qualify for Medicaid to cover the cost of a nursing home. That does happen. We have individuals who impoverish themselves quite quickly because their long-term health care needs are so immense. Then they qualify for Medicaid. We have situations where grandparents will illegally transfer their assets to their children to make them eligible for Medicaid. Our current system, I think, essentially promotes poverty while compelling a grandmother, for example, to be a crook. I actually did a speech on that subject after I researched it in California at a conference of legislators that gathered, and that caught their attention. You know, don't make grandma a crook. I mean, you set her up. She's worked all of her life. Her husband has left her lots of resources. What's she do when she gets to that point of the elderly need? She either impoverishes herself, or, you know, she tries to divest herself of those assets, which makes her a crook because the federal government doesn't allow you to do it. And that's really strange because in this country, we tout what we call the American dream, which means you're going to work and you're going to want to pass some of those assets on to your children. And yet, you don't have that option. You can't pass anything on to your kids when you have a system that promotes, I think, poverty and dishonesty by requiring that people use up all of their own assets before they're eligible for Medicaid, Medicare, and so on. I think we need to promote a public policy that rewards responsibility and promotes dignity. Stop and think about dignity for a minute. That's a word that really kind of gets me. In our culture, I question whether we really allow our elderly to keep their dignity. When we require them to spend their way into poverty, what are we doing to the human dignity of these people that have worked so hard all their lives? My preferred approach is to provide incentives for the purchase of long-term care insurance. Long-term care insurance is available, but as I said earlier, only 3% of people buy it. What can we do to get more people buying it? I would like to see Oregon provide a tax credit for those that purchase long-term care. That's one incentive. House Bill 2080, which is currently in House revenue, does that. We must also educate the public on the importance of planning for their long-term health care needs and their long-term care needs as well. And House Bill 2080 provides for that. But in addition to tax credits and public education, I think we need to have an assets waiver. I believe the state of Oregon should say to individuals who purchase long-term care insurance that they can preserve their assets and pass them on to their children if they still have further long-term care costs after they use their insurance. How this would work is that this is my own thinking here, and some states have tried it. If you buy an insurance at a certain level, it'll give you a certain level of benefits. Why not be immediately eligible? If you've set aside good amounts of money over the years in an insurance policy, if you've ever reached the benefit ceiling on that, why shouldn't you immediately be eligible for Medicaid and Medicare? These people that would buy this kind of insurance would be doing the responsible thing and should be eligible for Medicaid without impoverishing themselves. When we developed House Bill 2080 during the interim, I promoted my idea of the asset waiver. But I learned at that time that the federal government, in its Omnibus Reconciliation Act of 1993, required states to recover from the estates of all persons receiving assets or services under Medicaid, excuse me. Now, this is what's strange to me. At the time that this law went into effect in 1993, four states were effectively implementing an asset waiver already. And it was through a thing called the Partnership Program. Those states are California, Connecticut, Indiana, and New York. And those four states have been allowed to continue their program. But Oregon and other states can't start one now. Okay? Because it came after that 1993 Omnibus Act. So we can't implement the kind of program that I've just suggested, where if you buy long-term care insurance, you can keep your assets because you've kind of insured your ability to pass on some of your assets to your children. Those states have it, but we can't get it. Okay? So basically, Senate Joint Memorial 7 says it asks Congress to remove the disincentives in the Omnibus Reconciliation Act of 1993 so that states can provide incentives for the purchase of long-term care insurance. There is currently a bill in Congress to do this. The bill will not solve all the problems of long-term care. It will not allow for a comprehensive solution. It is simply one necessary step to get to where we need to be. Okay? It's one part of a comprehensive set of incentives, including tax credits, asset waivers, public education, and so on, so that consumers begin to understand the importance of planning for their long-term care needs. When I first started thinking about this bill, I recognized that nobody, and I say this with all respect to the chair, nobody ever wants to think at the age of 30, 40, 50, 60 that they're going to die in a nursing home. They don't want to think about that. Almost all of us like to think that we're just going to live up to one day and stop. So we are disinclined to even think about long-term care, let alone long-term care insurance. And that's why I bring this forward. I think it could help. I think it could save. If we would really implement this kind of an assets waiver, I think could save the country billions of dollars.
Senator.
Yeah.
When you were considering some of these things in the interim, did anybody ever consider doing a joint memorial to asking to do away with the inheritance tax, which in my way of thinking is a far greater disincentive than anything else for people to impoverish themselves or anything for them to impoverish themselves because having paid the tax burden that they pay, to have to again pay the tax burden that they bear or will bear, that their state will bear after they're gone, if they maintain their income and their financial status up to the end, that's a huge disincentive to not a fact. It's a great incentive to impoverish yourself.
Senator Fisher,
and thereby create dignity and have something
right
to pass on.
I understand what you're saying, Senator Fisher. I, not being facetious here, but I thought we were on the same committee, and I don't think we discussed that. This was simply an idea that I had. I don't pretend to be an expert in inheritance taxes, especially, and I think of this more.
Discuss it because I think I remember saying that it was absolutely crazy that after people got to the age of 60 or 65, it was far more to their benefit to get rid of their money than it was to make money because
yeah,
the percentage was better for them in the long run.
I agree.
Yeah.
and not, and I made the statement that it's terrible to take our people just because they've made a little money and then at a certain age make it to where they don't, they shouldn't be productive anymore.
Well, I've certainly heard you say that in this committee as well. There is a disincentive to work to make a good living after a certain age. I follow that totally.
Senator Sharon had a...
Well, I have a little problem with some of the things you said because my parents are there. They're older, almost 80. And the one thing that they really are of a concern is that they've saved their money not to distribute among us, but to not be a burden
right.
to society or to the family. And a mindset where people say, well, I'll save my money, and then when I get old, I'll get rid of it so I can live off the government. We're the government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the emphasis should be on the whole mindset here that I'm having problems with because it's wrong to give away these things so you can live off the government.
Oh, I absolutely agree, and it's actually a crime to do that. I'm not describing the ideal, I'm describing what happens. I'm describing that in the country today, I mean, certainly your parents and in my own family situation, this has not happened, okay? Your parents, for example, don't want to be a burden. My father is 87 now and he still lives out on the farm where I grew up and he's never been a burden to anybody. My mother passed away after a relatively short illness. My father was able to take care of her at home. So the ideal is one thing, and I'm certainly in agreement with you there, but I'm just saying that in all too many situations in the real world, people end up earning, and we're not talking about really wealthy people, we're talking about middle-class people that may have, you know, maybe $100,000 in assets, okay? And at the cost of health care today, in those last 2 years or 3 years of life, they can go through that $100,000 very quickly.
I think they should go through it instead of giving it away so they can live off the government.
That's fine. But a better system than going through that money very quickly would be if people would buy long-term care insurance to insure themselves, covering the cost of a nursing home, for instance, or in-home care. That insurance is available today, but people don't buy it. Only 3% of Americans buy that kind of insurance. It's there. We're just trying to create incentives to get people to buy that insurance more than they have in the past. 3% is very small. I mean, how many of us have automobile insurance? Almost all of us. How many, well, we're required to by law. How many of us have health care insurance? You know, probably 80% of us or whatever. 3% of us have long-term care insurance. That's because we don't like to think about the end of our life. We don't like to think about being in a nursing home or a foster home or whatever. So we don't buy that kind of insurance. All this memorial does is ask Congress to remove one disincentive to getting that insurance and to let the rest of the states be like California or New York or the other two states that have this mechanism. And the mechanism could probably be explained better by some of the others that are here this morning to testify, but it's an asset waiver mechanism where if you buy the insurance, okay, you have paid $200-$300 a month or whatever in premiums for 20 years. You have this nest egg. It's an insurance policy. You go to a nursing home, your expenses in that nursing home are paid for by the insurance policy. And because you've insured yourself, those assets that you've built up over the years don't get reduced to nothing. Okay?
You can legally keep your
assets. Yeah, you can legally, thereby, keep your assets because you've insured them, essentially. What you're doing is buying insurance for the nursing home, but in a real sense, it insures your assets so that your assets can then be passed on to your children.
Senator Duff, it seems to me like this is an education and an incentive.
Yeah, and that's why I talk about both. We need to educate people because most people don't know about long-term care insurance and don't want to, you know?
in a sense, we stay within reason. In a sense, long enough if this would happen, we would cut some of the government costs, too.
Right. We would save Medicare a lot of money. The more people you could get that would insure themselves. I have joked, excuse me for saying this in testimony, but I joke that this is the most Republican idea I've ever had, because it really is a private business solution. It's a private enterprise solution where you would have the insurance industry is out there right now selling the insurance, addressing a problem, and cutting the amount of Medicaid, Medicare money that has to be spent in this situation. Because the more people that would buy the long-term care insurance, the less people would be impoverishing themselves and using the federal government's money. Does that make sense?
Sure. I thought how expensive it is.
I think we've got some answers for how expensive it is back here.
Indiana and Columbia.
Yeah.
We'll fight them up.
Do you know?
Thank you, Senator Shue. Well, they've got, they've wanted to testify on it.
If nobody here has those figures, I know somebody does because I have heard the projection of what premium expenses would be. Of course, it's based on age. If you don't buy the insurance policy till you're in your 60s, they're going to be higher than if you started buying in your 30s.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, you signed up first. Go on.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America, and I'm here to support this Senate Joint Memorial. I think Senator Shields has covered the elements of the issue that are before you, and I can be very brief in what I would like to point out, in addition to his comments, the fact that Congress is actually looking at Medicare and Medicaid issues, and in the Medicare area, they're focusing on the cost of health care and how to control that when the baby boomers really hit. They are not focusing sufficiently, in my opinion, on the long-term care component of it. And there is a well-known journal called Health Affairs that is probably the best publication on health care policy issues in the country, and it devoted a recent issue to senior issues, including Medicare reforms. And consistently in the articles, what it was highlighting was the fact that the biggest gap for senior citizens, retirees, is long-term care insurance. And it was emphatic about the need to find ways to resolve the kind of gap in that kind of coverage. And I think for that reason, when you look at what this memorial does, it actually puts pressure again on Congress to call attention to that specific component related to long-term care. And I think that needs to be highlighted in the minds of members of Congress at the same time they're trying to deal with the cost of the health care expense. And clearly, I think the explanation that Senator Shields gave is that you need to have a greater proportion of the population covered with long-term care insurance in order to avoid the kind of spend down that occurs for people to get into Medicaid. And going to the question that was raised about the long-term care premium cost, when you take a look at Gwen's got numbers and I've got numbers, we'll see how close they are. in terms of, for example, if somebody buys a policy between the ages of 35 to 39, a coverage for 2 years in a nursing home would be approximately $358. A five-year policy would be $507. If a person buys in the category, excuse me.
A month, a year?
A year. Did I say a month?
No.
Oh.
Just one. You left it up in the air.
That would be the annual premium. Whereas if you waited until you were between 70 and 74, the premium cost would be approximately $2,600 a year for the two-year policy, and for a five-year policy, $3,600 a year. And so what happens is that these costs go up astronomically in terms of the age-graded kind of approach to the cost of long-term care insurance. the kinds of things that I think are significant here have been highlighted by Senator Shields. And so with that, I would urge your support and turn it over to Gwen.
Thank you. I'm Gwen Dayton with the Oregon Healthcare Association, also here to speak in support of the bill. And Senator Shields and Peggy have spoken very well to the need for individuals to plan for their own long-term care needs. And to what I would like to speak to briefly is the need for Oregonians as a society and for Americans to come to grips with the impact that long-term care is going to have on us as we grow older. There are lots of scary statistics, and Senator Shields has provided you with some of them. I won't go on and on with more, but just to let you know, in Oregon alone, the number of people over the age of 85 is going to quadruple. Those are the people that are the greatest purchasers of long-term care. And in the coming years, we're looking at four times as many people trying to access long-term care in Oregon alone. Medicaid caseloads are expected to at least triple. And I have read that by the year 2030, the total dollars spent on long-term care, public and private, will be equal to the Social Security budget today. So this is something that not only as individuals we need to deal with, in a way that, as Senator Shields indicated, preserves our dignity and allows our families to continue. As a society, we need to deal with this. And this memorial, again, focuses attention on that, and it's on the national level, and urges Congress to remove one of the disincentives to purchase what can be very valuable and helpful long-term care insurance. Very specifically, what Congress needs to do is remove the law that was passed in 1993 that provides that all states must recoup Medicaid dollars from the estate of someone who has received Medicaid dollars during their lives and now has died. The reason that that presents a problem for states that want to adopt partnership long-term care insurance in the way that's been discussed is because partnership long-term care insurance allows you to preserve your assets and hand them down to your family or have your family be able to use those assets. Currently, however, when you die, those assets go back to the state if you've used Medicaid during your life. So it limits the benefits of a partnership long-term care policy in a manner that has provided a significant disincentive for anyone to use them.
Can you describe how it works, for instance, in New York or California at the present time?
Chair Fisher, Senator Shields, absolutely. California and New York are several of the states that adopted partnership long-term care policies of insurance before 1993. And the way a policy would work in those states is you purchase a policy that has a benefit amount, and your assets would be protected from Medicaid eligibility considerations to the extent those benefits are paid out for your long-term care needs. So an example would be if you enter a nursing facility and your policy pays out $100,000 worth of benefits over the course of around 3 years, if you are still in need of long-term care and you've exhausted those benefits under the policy, your assets would then be excluded to the extent of $100,000. That's the amount of the benefits that have been paid out on your behalf by the partnership long-term care insurance policy. So if you had $101,000 of assets, let's say, for Medicaid purposes, they would think you only had $1,000 of assets. So that $100,000 can remain in the community for the community spouse, for example, or for the children. And just one more statistic, unless you're overloaded with them. Over half the couples that have one spouse in a nursing facility and one spouse in the community go bankrupt because all the resources go to pay for the spouse in the nursing facility. Partnership long-term care insurance would allow that spouse to be in the facility but have a community spouse still have some assets to live on. And the problem on the national level is that when the spouse in the nursing facility dies, the assets would be recouped by the state.
Mr.
Chair,
just one
more
question.
Yes,
Senator Shand is going to have to leave in a couple of minutes. So I'll make this very quick. Unless there's objection, I'd like to move on it. But in New York, California, where they have this system going, has it been around long enough to demonstrate that there is a saving to Medicaid and Medicare? Are we able to ascertain that saving, or has the percentage of people who've bought long-term care insurance been so small that we don't really have an accurate barometer yet?
Along that same line, how many of this 3% that have long-term care insurance are in those states? In other words, does that official come on to say that 2% of the 3% are in those states?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I don't know of any information, evaluation of those states, but we can certainly check that out. And we do have numbers, but I don't have them with me right now, in terms of how many people in those states have actually purchased these partnership plans. And I think that goes to the heart of Senator Shannon's question that, you know, saving for your later years, the projected cost of long-term care are so much more expensive over what a person would be expected to actually save. For example, if a person was going to be in a nursing home for 2 years at age 85, their expected costs were $489,000 for those 2 years in a nursing home. And when you take a look at the situation today, realistically speaking, most people do not have those kinds of assets, and so we're really talking about a situation that directly goes to middle-income and lower-income individuals because they do not have the kind of ability to make that kind of a savings to pay, and that's the reason we get into the Medicaid spend down and get into the nursing home.
What state are those projections from? Because as a nursing home operator, I want to transfer my business in.
These are national numbers, Senator Fisher, and they're from the American Council of Life Insurance, but they're projected from today's dollars to the early 2000s. So that's what they're projected with an inflationary impact in there. And I can make a copy of this for you for the record.
Well, it has to be well into the early 2000s to be that expense, because that's 10 times or at least 5 times what it is now, given the expensive. At least is what we're doing here on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because we are projected out.
I had one further question. Life insurance. How many percentage of people have life insurance?
I don't know the answer to that, Senator Fisher, and I can get that answer for you as well. What percentage of the population?
But obviously the government didn't push life insurance on people.
No.
What I'm getting at here in a not too subtle way, I'm going to spell it out for the record. The insurance companies went out and sold the product. That same market is out there right now. But it would seem to me that would be a huge incentive for some insurance companies to get out and start selling to people. For instance, I bought my first $10,000 life insurance policy at the age of 22. It cost me something like $12 or $13 a month. I would have probably just as readily, because that included a long-term care insurance and stuff like that, sprung forward at that time too, had it been presented by the person. I didn't go out and search for life insurance. The life insurance salesman came to me and visited me on his own and sold me the life insurance. I didn't even know I had a need for it at 22. Now, my feeling is here that how much of a come on do we need to stick under the insurance company's noses to get them on the ball? Same with health insurance. As I recall, health insurance people started clamoring around our businesses and things like that here some years ago, more on their own interest than actually we did in asking for them to start nosing around. And I'm wondering if maybe we shouldn't turn the private enterprise loose again and do a little bit of a challenge to the
insurance companies to get on the ball here and start spending some advertising dollars on and going out and hitting the public market.
Senator Fisher, speaking on behalf of HIA, that there's a number of carriers that offer long-term care insurance. I can assure you that they are aggressively marketing their long-term care policies. And actually, when you take a look at where there is a considerable growth going on in long-term care, but where the growth is occurring still is in people in their later years. And what we're trying to do and what this does is try and create another one of those incentives to get people to buy long-term care insurance at an earlier age.
Well, Senator Fisher, if I can just add briefly, you've raised, I think, a significant point that most people understand that they will die eventually. People want to protect their families. They want to provide assets to their family if something should happen unexpectedly or, of course, eventually we'll all die. But I don't think that there is an understanding among people that the number of them that will need long-term care. And there's a significant education that needs to go on in Oregon and across the nation that 2 out of every 5 people over the age of 50 will need long-term care and that it's excessive. And that's the significant component of this. What this memorial does is remove one disincentive on the national level to provide for a particularly beneficial kind of long-term care insurance. And it's one step in a long process of helping people understand the need for long-term care insurance and encouraging them to buy it.
Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial Number 7 and open a work session on Senate Joint Memorial Number 7. And with that, I'm also going to declare a potential conflict of interest. The fact that I am a nursing home owner, operator, and administrator, so I could be financially remunerated to some extent if this were to take and catch fire. Comments?
Yeah. I don't mean to be kind of dull, but is it illegal now for this to happen in Oregon? We need Congress to do something for us to do it?
Yes, Congress did. Through the OBRA, what was
it? 93. So we can't do that in Oregon, have that?
Not without a waiver or not without a change in the law.
Okay.
And they've been denying waivers, so that means basically a change in the law, which this speaks to.
I moved the last one, but I'm happy to move this particular
joint. Memorial. Seven.
Happy to move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves. Joint Memorial Number 7 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Shields, you're straight.
Do we have to vote on this? I guess we don't have to
vote. We have to vote on it. He's going to call it. I just was going to.
Sure. I'd be glad to.
All right. I was just getting that done so we didn't.
But I was just going to ask one question. There must be another side to this story. And no one knows why Congress did it.
I can try and explain that Congress was looking out for their purse strings, at least they thought so, by saying, look, if Medicaid, Medicare pays anything for anybody that goes to a nursing home or a foster home, we want to recover that money. Okay? We're trying to be good stewards of the taxpayers' money. So we're going to go after the estate of anybody that's used Medicaid or Medicare.
Isn't that only to the portion that they use? If there's any left over, sure. The family gets.
Sure, right.
So if insurance pays that, I don't. There's something not. There's something.
It is confusing. If insurance.
It's not confusing. Something's missing.
Well, I'm not. If either of the ladies want to come up and try and answer that, I'd be.
Well, I think I can answer that.
Okay.
It's merely the average stay in a nursing home is longer than a hospital. And something like 6 months on the average. So this would allow for several times the average stay in a nursing home paid for by insurance at no cost to the government built up during your lifetime. So that the few then that go over the BP average would also have the incentive for doing that, without spending the money to save the government the money in the first place. If everybody had a 2-year policy of insurance, the federal government wouldn't be involved, nor the state government, to any great extent at all. It would be a huge amount of the, a huge percentage of the amount of money that's spent now would be taken care of privately. And so it's to encourage that, that this is being done, because it would probably more than cut by two-thirds what the government would pay if everybody had a two-year.
Senator Fisher, I understand the encouragement. I just don't understand what the government has for not encouraging this. Is it to save government jobs so they can be doing it?
Well,
why does the government want this to stay in the government?
I can't answer for government because we do a lot of things here that don't make sense to me either in the light of saving government money. And I guess I could talk a long time on what Open 93 did as far as what sent to us by the federal government.
Mr. Sheriff, I might. I understand Senator Shannon's question. It is a good one. It isn't obvious at first why they would want to go after, you know, why they would prohibit states from setting up this insurance that would supposedly save them a lot of money.
Right.
But I don't, I honestly believe this. I don't think that government has comprehended this issue any better than the public out there at large. And until you understand that if you buy $100,000 worth of insurance or $200,000 or $300,000, that the government is only interested in the money that's after that $100,000 or $300,000, that if say you had a mistake of $400,000 and you were insured for $300,000, that the government would only go after that last $100,000 of your assets, and that you could still, your estate would still have the $300,000 to disperse the family and so on. I don't think that government really thought that through or really understood that.
Well, maybe
because if they had, I don't think they'd have the over 93 provision.
Maybe government did, but the legislators thought it through. I mean, the decision was made by
Washington.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They heard both sides. I'm just saying, I'll vote for it, but there's a side I haven't heard.
There must be some, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you guys can come up with an answer to that question, I'd sure be interested in it. Because it doesn't make sense.
Well, I, yeah.
I'll vote for it. Let's just go. I have
a problem with lots of things that happened back in Washington, D.C. as far as making dollars and cents. That's another forum. Go ahead and, Mr. Clerk, would you ask them to call the roll?
Aye.
Senator
Jill.
Aye.
Senator Jill.
Aye.
Senator Connors.
Aye.
Aye. I can see it's
maybe every time tonight. SJM 7 passes, and Senator Shields will be the carrier, and we will public hearing on Senate Bill 1291. Rocky, do you want to come and help us out with this quickly?
Senator Fisher and members of the committee, my name is Rocky King, and I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which is the agency that administers the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. I apologize for not having any written testimony this morning. I will get it over to you. For some reason there's a scheduling conflict here and it didn't make it here. FEOP, which is how we refer to the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, came from legislation passed last session and was implemented July of last year. We currently have about 5,200 people that are receiving the subsidy and enrolled in insurance plans, another 2,000 that have been accepted for the subsidy and are currently in the process of trying to obtain insurance, either in the group or individual markets. In addition to that, we have about 6,500 individuals that are on a waiting list as openings will occur in order to get the subsidy. Senate Bill 1291 does three things to the program, and they're rather simple but important to us. The first one is nothing more than technical adjustments replacing the term subsidy in the place of voucher. We used vouchers when the bill was first passed, but in fact we say subsidies. We don't provide people with a voucher. So we're just doing some technical cleanup there. The second change that the bill makes, though, is somewhat important in that it allows the board to define a certain benefit level available to those who are receiving the subsidy in the group market, that if the benefit level doesn't meet the criteria established by the board, those individuals would have the option of enrolling in an individual insurance plan rather than through their employer. And when you first passed this legislation, you felt, and rightfully so, it was very important that when a group health insurance policy was available to someone, that they had to enroll in that plan, irrespective of what the benefit or cost was. Well, the problem we've run into are there are individuals out there that earn $700, $800, $900 a month, or $1,400 a month for a family of two, and their employer may provide a health benefit plan, but it's a $1,000 or a $500 deductible plan. For somebody that makes $700 a month, it just is, it doesn't, it's not insurance to them because it still has that barrier. So what we've said is that the board is going to do a study over the next 6 months. If this bill passes, look at what benefit plans people are enrolling in the group market and try to do a matchup to ensure that those plans meet the basic needs from an economic standpoint of those individuals. And if they don't, they'll draw a line and say any group benefit plan, for example, above $400 deductible or an 80-20 copay, or if it's just a catastrophic plan, the individual does not have to choose that plan. They have the option to take a better benefit plan in the individual market. So that's the second change that this bill makes. The third point is that it deletes a limiting language that would prevent us from utilizing federal dollars in our particular program. When we first passed this legislation again last session, we said that none of the subsidy money could be used for premium, or could be used only for premiums, but not copays and deductibles. Well, what we're doing now is going to the federal government asking for approval to be able to use federal funds in the FIAT program for children, and that's children only. But there are some limitations that the federal government makes when you purchase health insurance for children. One of those is that you can't have premiums, copays, and deductibles, for example, that exceed 5% of the family's income. And I'm talking about only for those children. So what this bill would allow us to do would be to use some of the federal and with the state matching funds to pay some of the copays and deductibles for children that were enrolled in the FIAT program if they were eligible under the federal CHIP program. So it gets kind of confusing when you talk about some of these little technical changes. There's nothing really substantive in this bill in terms of changing the direction of the program, but only some fine-tuning that again, allows us to serve our clients better, and number two, really hopefully accept some federal funds if they become available to us in October.
Yes.
So this last point you made, that's only if we get these extra federal dollars in October, then it would allow us to take advantage of those in this way?
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, that's correct.
It's not like we have federal money sitting there right now that we just can't use.
There is federal money that is available to us, but we need to get the federal government permission to use that money. Most of the federal, what's called CHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program, federal dollars is being used by the Medicaid, OHP Medicaid, and the CHIP expansion. And what we're trying to do, because there's more money available than what they're using, is to use some of that to help individuals purchase private health insurance, not just to enroll in a Medicaid look-alike CHIP program.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Why would you just limit this for use for copays and deductibles for children only rather than anyone who would be in the FIAT program?
Yes, Senator Fisher, Senator Castillo, the federal dollars can only be used for children up to through the age of 19 that are under 170% of the federal poverty level. So you can't use the federal dollars for the adults, except that when it is cost effective, for example, in a group plan where you may have a dependent spouse and two children, and where it doesn't cost you any more money to add the spouse as long as you have the family rate, and then we'll be able to use the federal dollars there, but only when there is no additional cost.
I understand. I hope you won't ask what they were thinking about when they did this.
Not today.
Further discussion, questions around? Maybe there's no one else that signed up to testify for this. We want to close the public hearing and open a little session on Bill 1291. Further comments, objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Do you need a motion?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1291 to the floor with a detailed recommendation.
Senator Shields moves the Senate Bill 1291 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, go ahead, Mr. Clerk.
Senator Dillon?
Aye.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator
McCain?
Aye.
Senator Kerry?
Aye.
Do you carry this
one? Sure.
Okay, Senator Duncan will be the carrier on Senate Bill 1291, and I will close the work session on 1291 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 765. I'd like to call Stan and Barbara Ash. Thank you for your patience and long suffering here as we waded through the business of the morning here.
Good morning, and thank you very much. I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 765, which creates Caring for Oregon's Children with Autism Task Force, and it authorizes Task Force to study and make legislating recommendations for the state residential school for children with autism.
Would you state your name for our record?
Okay.
That's all right.
It's Barbara Ash. Autism is a severely incapacitating lifelong developmental disability that typically appears during the first 3 years of life. The result of a neurological disorder that affects functioning of the brain, autism and its behavioral symptoms occur in approximately 15 out of 10,000 births. Autism is four times more common in boys than girls. It has been found throughout the world in families of all racial, ethnic, and social backgrounds. No known factors in the psychological environment of a child have been shown to cause autism. Some behavioral symptoms of autism include disturbances in the rates of appearance of physical and social language and skills, abnormal responses and sensations. Any one of the combinations of senses or responses are affected. Sight, hearing, touch, balance, smell, taste, reaction to pain, and the way a child holds his or her body. Speech and language are absent or delayed, while specific thinking capabilities may be present. Abnormal ways of relating to people, objects, and events. Autism occurs by itself or in association with other disorders, which affect the function of the brain, such as viral infections, metabolic disturbances, and epilepsy. It is important to distinguish autism from retardation or mental disorders, since diagnostic confusion may result in referral to inappropriate and ineffective treatment techniques. The severe form of the syndrome may include extreme self-injurious, repetitive, highly unusual, and aggressive behavior. Autism is treatable. Early diagnosis and intervention of a highly structured program are vital to the future and development of a child. 70 to 80% of individuals with autism also have retardation. And 20 to 30% of autistic people are of normal to above normal intelligence. Dr. Eric London of the National Alliance for Autism Research near Princeton, New Jersey, states, "The disorder is poorly understood, but is thought to begin in early pregnancy through some combination of genetics and a toxin, virus, or some other agent. and I'd like to say that in Trenton, New Jersey, they found that 40 cases were diagnosed among a town in New Jersey, and 6,000 3 to 10-year-olds, more than three times the estimated national average of 1 in 500 children are autistic. Basically, sometimes they think, like in Massachusetts, they have a foster grant plan that makes sunglasses. And parents that grew up around the lake in that area, they have children, and many of their children were autistic. We had 140 autistic children that were born to those parents, so that's why they think toxins may have something to do with autism. Yeah. Autism is increasing. A California study found a 400% increase in the last 12 years. He blames pollution, food additives, vaccines, and the overuse of antibiotics. And some simply say that this reflects better diagnosis of children, meaning a lot of children, you know, are better diagnosed. And this person was Dr. Bernard Rimland, who is director of Autism Research Institute in San Diego. Children with autism often seem to live in a world of their own. In the most severe cases, they are unable to communicate or to make eye contact. The symptoms of the disorder is unclear. It is thought to begin early in pregnancy and to be at least possibly genetic. Again, I've said that to you before.
Yes, ma'am. I was just wondering what your interest is in this issue. Are you a parent of an autism?
Yes, I'd like to say I have four children. I have a girl who is out of college and is working, and I have a boy who is 20 years old who is autistic, who lives in a residential program in Salem, and that's Christopher. And then Jonathan, I have a child who has attention deficit disorder and attends the public school system in Lake Oswego, and I have a child who has dyslexia, who is 13 years of age, and he's also in like a Oswego public school.
Sure. I just comment that Santa Barbara really have done a lot of work in this area, and they've really been leaders in our area. So I appreciate them coming, and I know that they're really, really dedicated people today.
Well, thank you so much, Senator Duncan. And I guess today what I'd like to tell you, I'd just like to give you some little information about my son Christopher, because he is in a residential program, and he was in a residential program from age 7 and on. And I had written this letter to the Lake Oswego School Board on March 30th, 1993, and I'll just give you a little bit of case history about what happened to Christopher. Christopher is 14 years of age and has the mentality of a 3-year-old child. He is retarded and autistic. When you think of a graph between 1, the least autistic, and 5, the most autistically handicapped, Christopher is a 2-3 level. On a level from 1 to 4, these children are usually teachable and will learn and may also grow up to hold jobs with assistance. Children on a 4-5 level are sometimes institutionalized. Their learning ability is severely impaired. They can be abusive to themselves and to others. They throw tantrums. They throw themselves into walls, they scratch, they bite, they hit themselves. Every autistic child is different. The ability to teach them varies from child to child. 2 years al ago, Christopher had a grand mal seizure and was hospitalized. He has had 2 seizures over the last 6 months, and he is on medication. Christopher's history follows. Under the care of Jeffrey Sosnick and Douglas Golden, Ph.D., clinical psychologist, Dr. David Porter, M.D., 2 years of age, he was diagnosed retarded and autistic. You can imagine having a healthy baby, you think, and then finding out your child is really handicapped. 3 years to 4 years of age, Christopher attended a school in Milwaukee with the blind, the deaf, the Down syndrome children. When he was 5 years old, he attended a Good Sam hospital preschool. When he was 5 years old, we hired a full-time tutor for our one-on-one training because my husband read an article in a magazine, and he found out a gentleman named Dr. Louvois, who was a doctor who also had an autistic child, and he stated that children that were autistic did better with one-on-one training, better than a classroom setting. Kelly Center was recommended by the school district, and we did go to the Kelly Center to see where our child would be attending. There were 7 autistic children in the classroom and only 1 teacher and 1 helper. One child fell on his head twice on the floor while we watched. One child, another child, was getting up from his chair and he was throwing his body against the walls. How are these autistic children getting a proper education? Because the other children that were sitting there, the other two teachers were running after them, and this is what the school systems were offering. They weren't getting an education. Dr. Tom Nakata from the University of Oregon Medical Center took me to an autistic schoolroom in the Lake Oswego school system. The children were 12 to 14 years of age. When a child misbehaved or did not complete a test, they would get Tabasco sauce, lemon juice, vinegar, or, as the teacher expressed, anything bad tasting poured into their mouths. After being horrified at the education of the Lake Oswego school system, what they would be offering our child, we decided to go out on our own and find an education that would be good for him. That's when we contacted Dr. Lavas from UCLA Medical School in California, who is known to be a specialist around the world in autism. He told us to hire a tutor. Autistic children need one-on-one training. We hired a tutor for Christopher and placed him in a Montessori school, and he attended the school with a tutor until he was age 7 years of age, seven. At the age of seven, Christopher was getting too old for the school. His behavior was changing at home. He was hanging out windows. He was breaking windows with his hands. He was eating plants, dirt, pillows. He was chewing up stuffed animals, clothes, almost anything and everything. He was up at 5 a.m. in the morning, and he was down at 9 p.m., screaming, jumping, chewing, eating. Our home was like a prison. It was locked from the inside and out. He showed no emotion whatsoever. He did not hug, nor did he even want to be hugged or touched because his autism made him so. I knew at this point that Christopher needed to be in residential school where he could be educated properly if there was any hope for his future. So Christopher left for Japan to a wonderful residential program, something the United States did not have at the time. Hagashi was established by Dr. Kitahara. We never sent our child away because we did not want him. We loved him and we wanted to make it better and give him a chance. Christopher was in Japan for 2 years. We would visit him and he would visit us. The school moved to Boston 5 years ago, and Christopher entered the school there. And then what we did was we left him in the school until he was age 18, and we brought him back, and he is now living in Shangri-La, which is a private and a government-run facility, and he's doing wonderful. I had written a story when Christopher was very young, and in there I stated that what would I want his future to be, and it would be that I would want him to live in a home where he would have friends and where he would have a job, and that's what's happening right now. He's with four other handicapped adults, and he is working in little plants, and he's putting bolts in the tray, and they're spray painting them, and I feel so good about that. And Christopher comes home 3 days a month, and because of his disability, he's become quite violent, and it's getting harder and harder for Stan and I to have him at home, but he's doing well. And I just want to read a small paragraph here from Mr. Robert Crabtree, who is an attorney in Massachusetts. And he states, "We've seen cases of students being placed in fourth or fifth grade classes while still reading at a first grade level. These students were expected to understand the grade level content of social studies, science, math, and word problems. These students hadn't even mastered phonics, and their disability interfered with their ability to figure out what a word means. In many cases, this, the child's needs and the real conditions of the mainstream classroom are such that there is just no way that the regular class teacher, no matter how good, can spend enough time or practice enough modifications or strategies to allow a child to progress in her maximum potential within the mainstream setting." And then the reason, and one other thing, the reason that Christopher did need a residential program and the reason that he could not be mainstreamed in the school setting was during a judicial hearing that was held April 1991, at which time Dr. Mary Cerretto, director of psychology in the Franciscan Children's Hospital in Boston, testified that Christopher needed a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour program because consistency was crucial to any educational growth. And this is her quote. "Chris is not going to be the type of child that is going to learn how to brush his teeth in the classroom. He's not going to learn how to buy things in a classroom store. He is not going to know how to go to bed. Chris needs to be taught in a natural environment because his cognitive abilities are so low he can't generalize from one environment to the next. The things he needs to learn range from the entire 24-hour day. The federal district court concluded that Dr. Shredo's testimony was compelling and that Christopher needed 24-hour, 7-day-a-week environment, while residential placements for a handicapped child is only appropriate in very limited circumstances. Christopher's medical, social, and emotional problems were so severe that they are not, they didn't help his learning process, and therefore residential placement is required for educational purposes.
So, with your bill,
yes,
you're saying there is no autism, what do you say, autism task force? There's no special focus on this situation?
Well, what they do is they mainstream the children. I'll tell you one thing. I've been, because I have two other children with disabilities, I have Andrew, who had dyslexia. When the children start receiving grades in their sixth grade report card, my child received straight F grades, even though he had a normal to above normal IQ. And what they did was I raised holy heck, of course. And what they did was they started a class, and it's called a contained classroom. And what they did was they hired two special education teachers. They put my child with 9 other children from disabilities. They could range from anything to ADD, dyslexia, autistic. And they put these children in this classroom, and actually my child made the honor roll. He was always a smart boy, but I just don't, it's not that some of the teachers didn't care about him, it's just he was lost in the classroom. And even though he was getting his money, he wasn't really getting money for his,
Senator Shannon Stanish is my name. Currently most of the school districts, depending upon which one it is, will determine how they're going to handle autism.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the school districts in the Portland metro area will bring the autistic children, I think, to King School for some training. As far as there being a residential program in the state of Oregon at this time, I do not believe any exists that deals with autistic students of educational age. And let me just add in right now that we're not looking for something that's going to require any new funding. Currently, the school systems throughout the Oregon receive a certain amount of money from individual education programs. There's also money that comes in from the federal funding for American for Disabilities Act. So our intent is to look into this as to whether or not it is feasible to open up a residential autistic school in the state of Oregon. It may or may not.
This will be the first step.
I believe this would be the first step, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have to leave that. If you do a work session, I would like to do this. But I would just like to say, I can't even imagine what you've gone through, but hope through it all, because you're strong.
Mm-hmm.
And your kids are blessed to have you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, really going to that for them. Mm-hmm.
And for other children, too.
That's what I'm
here fighting for them because they need the help.
Thank you on behalf of all those kids.
Yes, as I said earlier, because you have gone to that for other kids, and obviously there are families who do not have the resources you have to be able to do this.
That's true, absolutely.
And, and that's what I think you're pushing for to help us.
That's right.
You have to understand
that then their children to Japan and so forth.
That's right.
Senator Duncan, and excuse me for interrupting you, the point here is I think it isn't necessarily what it does for the children. Yes, it's good to help the autistic children. Some of them can fully function after they go through, whether it's Dr. Mezabob's ideas or Dr. Kitahara's ideas or mm-hmm. Dr. Lavasa's ideas. But the point is what it does for the family that's left at home.
That's right.
An autistic child there, some of these families that we visited, one in Lake Oswego, I can't remember their names, but basically they couldn't have any flowers or any plants in their backyard because their child destroyed them all. I mean, either by eating them or by just tramping all over them. Mm-hmm. And our own feelings, as I said, I'm going to try to avoid any emotionalism, but I know that when I took my son to Japan and back and forth to Boston, it was like being given new life again. Right. And it's hard to explain it to anyone, but it, you know, you love your child. It's kind of a hate and love relationship, and that's why this task force to us, where it leads, I don't know, but at least to get it started as soon as possible, to at least look into it, mm-hmm. and if it turns out fine, then great. If not, then I guess that's life.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether this is a necessary emergency or anything like that, but whatever.
Does it have an emergency clause on it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we need to add it. Yeah. Do you know if you plan to work the Dale Center, Sam?
Well, I had some thoughts. I don't know how many task forces can logically be worked, and we're very definitely proceeding toward a task force on mental health parity, which would include probably help in treating this particular situation would be included, I'm sure. And I thought some about possibly seeing if we could combine the two and study this whole problem. What I'd like to do today, probably just take the testimony, and if there's an indication of an emergency clause, we have that drafted up to put in
with
that, so that's possible and get it ready. I'd like to kind of consult with leadership a little bit to see what their recommendations would be. I don't want to just totally burden them down with more task forces and things than they were prepared to handle. So we wanted to get it in here so we had it done well before our deadlines. And Senator Shields.
I was going to suggest that either today or when we work the bill, if you'd like to have a little bit more input on what it's like to have for a child with autism and to deal with that, Catherine White in the back of the room has an autistic child. Also, my legislative aide, Sonia Fisher, who's in the back of the room, has an autistic child, and both have shared stories similar to your own. It would certainly be a lot more information and kind of you'd have a better feel for this.
Sure, I think Barbara Roberts still lives with it. I think her son.
I've talked to her.
Senator Fisher,
yes,
would the task force you just mentioned be competing for the same funds that this task force would be competing for? They seem to think that it would not be a drain.
Mr. Chair, looks like Catherine White does want to say something about weigh in on this. Is that, can you give her an opportunity to say something?
And may I give this to you? This is a daily life therapy guidelines. This is a residential autistic school, and this is how they put it together. It has any, all facts, all information, everything you need.
Sure, we might pass on to leadership to be a burden on them, but it certainly might help take a big burden off.
Yes, I understand that.
Yeah, no, I understand. I need to help the leadership out with all this here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council, and as Senator Shields mentioned, I'm also the parent of a 20-year-old son with autism. In fact, as I listened to Barbara talk about her son, I realized that we probably have passed, our kids have been in programs together, I believe, at various times. I just wanted to address the issue of a task force. During the interim, the Department of Education pulled together a group of families, educators, and other folks interested and concerned about children with autism in the state of Oregon, and spent many, many months looking at services and preparing an interim report on the educational issues around autism. In the previous, I believe it was in the 95 legislative session, in fact, there was an agreement worked out to try and develop an interim plan on kids with autism. We feel the situation, the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council has been concerned about the situation for kids with autism for a very, very long time.
The plan, our belief is the plan is really just the beginning, and that we would support an interim task force that looks at this whole range of services and actually puts budget numbers to it. I think that people are really unaware of the incredible crisis that both school districts and families are in at this point in dealing with children with autism. At this point, the regional program, which provides technical assistance to school districts for kids with autism, those autism specialists have caseloads of over 1 to 80. They're providing barely sufficient support to local school districts. The developmental disabilities program is now taken over some of the residential programs. Prior to this time, families who had children with autism, like the Ashes, that needed residential supports, had to go to SCS and say that they were about to abuse their children in order to get residential services. It is an untenable situation, and I would say that we would support a very broad-based work group building on what the department has put so much effort into at this point and bringing in the other human resource agencies in order to come back to this legislature with a true picture of what the situation is and what the budget ramifications would be and, frankly, are currently for local school districts, families, and human resource programs. I do not believe that this, unfortunately, fits into the mental health parity issue. Autism is considered a developmental disability, and I guess I would like to work with the ASHES and other members to see, and with the department, to see if we can figure out a way to support such a task force figure out if we can come up with some creative alternatives in terms of the cost in supporting the task force, because we recognize that to have such a task force, there is a fiscal impact. But I guess I would just urge you to consider this legislation and allow us some time. I was not aware the bill was coming up today and frankly did not contact the ASHES prior to this time. And so I think we could work together on this.
Did I understand your son is around 20?
My son has turned 20 last week.
So they're just almost the same
age. Yeah.
My son is also in a residential program. He had some very, very hard times. He's 6'3". He was too big for me. I couldn't handle it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I work closely with the program. I'm aware and have a lot of contact with many families. I think we can do better educationally to prevent some of the issues. Both of our sons went through programs that were very aversive. And sometimes when you deal with children with violence, even though people tell you it's the right way to do it, you create adults who are violent. I think we've learned a lot in the 20 years that we've been faced with this issue. But I think that one of the struggles we face is getting that information out to the schools and providing educators and families with the appropriate training. Autism is a profoundly devastating disability, one of the very worst. And it is something that both families and schools need to be working closely together. And,
instead of fighting, which seems to be, you have a child with a disability, and if your child's failing or isn't getting help, you're considered a problem, and that's been the case with all my children, actually. Yeah. Which shouldn't have to be, it's still happening. You know, and just one other thing, I have a boy with ADD, went from a three-year private school to a public, had a 3.5 grade average, he's getting a 1.87 at the public school. So what is wrong with our education? There's something not right, you know. And there are a lot of parents like myself that would testify and say the same thing.
Catherine, you work quite a bit with, in the area of disabilities and things like that. Was that brought on by the experience that you had with a child
or was that primarily something that you had as a vocation?
Mr. Chair, in my former life, I was a school teacher. I taught high school. And when it became very clear that my son was going to be disabled, just no longer seemed appropriate that I spend my time working with other people's kids and not working on my own. So yes, in my former life I was a school teacher, and I got into this because of my experience with my son.
Mr. Chair? I really appreciate Catherine's offer to work with the ASHES on this. I think what we have with her was her body of knowledge on the issue of the services or lack of services that we have in our state for developmentally disabled people, I think helps to, add a statewide perspective and kind of put the issue of autism in the context of the overall picture of what we, we have a very long line of people who are not getting their help for their family members, and so I think with all of you working together, we could put together something that would really be very, very helpful to the state, and I'm very excited to see you guys team up and see this happen. So.
And Ms. Fisher, would you want a chance to say something at this time? Would you like to? I don't want to push you into doing something you're not prepared to do, but if you would care to come forward, we'd be more than happy to give you a chance to go on record at this time.
For the record, my name is Sonia Fisher, and I am from Gresham, Oregon. And just one point I'd like to emphasize in the testimony that I've heard this morning is that I think it's really essential to take a holistic look regarding all of the services for children with autism. Catherine mentioned education, human services, and the family. I just really want to emphasize that point, that any work that we do for the legislature, to bring information back to the legislature, that it's essential to look at all aspects. Like Catherine, I have a child that has Angelman syndrome and autism. And when she was 8 years old, we placed her out of our home because we could no longer provide for her care. And at that time, there was not adequate, sufficient in-home support for our family. There was not training available. There was not connection with the school district to work as partnerships to address some of the issues. Dealing with children with autism is you need to take a holistic approach among all of the elements of care, education, family, and human service providers. It's really, really essential. So I just want to say that that I support that aspect to have a task force to look at those aspects of caring for a child with autism. I think that's really, really important.
How old is your daughter now?
She celebrated her 14th birthday yesterday. And where is she now? We have a very creative solution for her care needs at this point. She is living with her grandparents, and staff go to their home to provide the direct care. She requires one-on-one assistance for the time that she is awake. And so she is there, and we, in a sense, have an extended, supported family, and that we're all very connected and very close, that she's getting the care that she requires. And she has a very, very good situation. But it took us, 6 years to get here today, and it was great. It was her birthday yesterday. We spent the day at North Clackamas Aquatic Park, and Christine had so much fun in the water, and we played, and we had a great time, and we went into the birthday room and celebrated her birthday with our extended family and a couple of her friends, and then it was time for her to go. The noise and everything had gotten to her. She led me to the door, and I was like, okay, we'll see you later. But that was something that would not have been possible a few years ago, but it's been because of the care and the treatment over the last few years that she's been able to be at that point.
All three of you have a manifold years of experience dealing with this. Thank you very much. We'll pursue getting an emergency partner in here, and it may not be necessary if we have the support of the leadership, because they don't actually have to have a bill to start a task force. You know, do that on their own situation. So we'll pursue it, and thank you so much for coming and putting your emphasis on it and being willing to come and tell experiences that are obviously very moving to all of you, as they are to us to hear them.
Mr. Chair, might I request that we work together and possibly propose some amendments to this legislation so that we can kind of delineate what topic and range of discussion would be in the, if the legislation were to move forward.
Certainly fine with me. I directed there.
And we would work with the Department of Ed and the other agencies as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Hughes, do you wish to put anything on record? You just hear what representative told you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
1 minute, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ed Hughes. I got a call one day from a staff person that works for Stan Ash with a request to go help Barbara Ash because her son was home and she was having trouble handling her son. And they found Stan before I got a chance to get out of the house, which I was very glad for. But that's what got my attention on this subject. And this bill has been needed a long time ago. And I don't know why it didn't come forward. It just didn't happen. But now we've got it here and before the committee, and we certainly appreciate your opportunity for a hearing, sir. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ed. Okay, well, thank you all for coming and being very patient and waiting here through the process. And we certainly will be available to work on amendments. And I personally will follow through with talking to leadership. And with that, I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 765 and close the session for the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services.